What are the implications of a low-rate environment for investing and for the future of financial stability in a world where central banks have taken on a much bigger role and where markets are easily disrupted? For how long will interest rates remain at historic lows? Will monetary policy and colossal QE programs be enough to light a match under economies reeling from the pandemic crisis? And will real interest rates below zero in many countries? What does this mean for the world's pension funds and the savers relying on them? I'm Anna Pavlova, Professor of Finance at London Business School and Academic Director of the AQR Asset Management Institute. The Insight Summit is our annual flagship event, and this year it occurred as the global economy faces potentially even greater threats than after the 2008 financial crisis. We were fortunate to have a stellar lineup of speakers from industry, policy, and academia, including our own world-leading faculty. Our first session on low rates, causes and consequences was delivered by Hélène Rey, Lord Raj Bagri, Professor of Economics at London Business School and a member of the French Macroprudential Authority, though speaking in an individual capacity. As a macroeconomist, Professor Rey delivered a big picture perspective on the possible drivers of real interest rates and what the outlook is for the future of macroeconomic policy. Using data going back 100 years, she says we can take guidance from historic rates in the UK and the US as to what is happening with real rates in the recent period.
In economics, real rate of interest are determined by the demand and supply of funds. So when we have periods of high savings and relatively weak investment demand, real rates tend to be low. And why could we be in such a period right now? Well, there are several explanations that are being put forward. We can think about explanations which are based on structural trends. We can also think of explanations which are linked to financial cycles, and in particular, especially boom-bust cycle. And finally, of course, the COVID-19 shock, and which effect does that have on the market for demand and supply of funds. So I'm going to look at those issues and try to give you my views. The structural trends explanation for low real rates. This is what is often called the secular stagnation view after this term was resurrected by Larry Summers in 2013, describing the kind of unusual economic situation, macroeconomic situation that we have been in for quite a few years. Now, there's another view, which is the financial cycle view, which is the boom-bust cycle view. The story goes as follows. First, we may have seen, as in the 1990s and 2000, excessive supply of funds due to financial deregulation, for example, due to expansionary monetary policy and exuberance in markets. Second, we've seen a financial crisis. And this financial crisis has led to a decrease in aggregate demand, deleveraging. This could have been a source of decrease for the real rate. So, does secular stagnation mean low for long and boom bust mean up shortly? Well, I think it is not so simple. We have to ask ourselves how persistent are those trends? And how transitory are those boom busts, and vice versa, of course. We have to be asking the data to speak louder. And how do we make the data speak louder? Well, in order to make the data speak louder, we have to speak a little bit in math.
This is where it gets a bit technical. But for the macroeconomics enthusiasts, Professor Rey goes deep into the data and shows how future real rates can be predicted based on a country's consumption to wealth ratio.
I'm going to start with a pretty non-controversial identity, which is the world budget constraint. We can rewrite it simply expressing an interesting concept here, which is the consumption wealth ratio. We can express it as a sum of expected future real risk-free rates plus a sum of expected future risk premia minus a sum of expected future consumption growth. Something very interesting happens when you look at this data on consumption wealth ratio. You see that there are two periods in which it went down significantly. This is around the Great Depression and around the financial crisis of 2008. Okay, and in both cases, interestingly, these are times where there were talks of secular stagnation. So now the question is, what does the consumption wealth ratio with this behavior around the big financial crisis tell us possibly about future real rates? When the consumption wealth ratio goes down, future real rates seem to go down as well. This is what the data says. And again, I've used only an accounting identity. I have not used any assumption here or anything. So the data has told me this. Consumption wealth ratio today tells me something about the movements in future real rates. Now, I'm going to add my own narrative to this finding coming from the data. And I'm going to say, let's look at a narrative that makes sense of the movements in consumption wealth ratios and the subsequent movements in real rates that are predicted by the consumption wealth ratio. And so here's my narrative. In the 1920s, just like in 1990-2000, we see a sharp decline in the consumption wealth ratio. These are two periods where wealth grows faster than consumption. These are two periods where there was a lot of exuberance in financial markets. So wealth grows quickly, more quickly than consumption, and so the consumption wealth ratio goes down. Both periods end with a big financial banking crisis. We have 1929 and we have 2008. After that big financial crisis, we see a period of deleveraging, weak aggregate demand, so low real rate, and the talk of secular stagnation comes in. So the pattern is pretty similar in both cases. We are talking about a boom, consumption wealth ratio going down because wealth goes up quickly, a big bust with the banking crisis, and then a period of deleveraging and weak aggregate demand, which leads to low real rates. This seems consistent with what we see in the data. Now, if this is the right narrative, we can also think about whether the current period is here for us to stay. Well, these boom busts are extremely persistent when they are based on financial crisis with banking crisis. We know, we have studied them, there's a lot of propagation mechanisms and scaring effects in the macroeconomy if you have a big banking crisis. And these lead to periods of prolonged, weak aggregate demand. This seems to be what we have been seeing in the 30s and what we have been seeing after 2008. We have just used the information in the consumption wealth ratio to project the real rate, 10-year average future short real rate between 2015 and 2025. Okay, so what we see here is that this 10-year average future short real rate is low and will remain low. And on average, we find minus 3.1%. So it's lower for longer, based on these data on the consumption wealth ratio. Now, this is not even talking about COVID-19 and the COVID-19 shock. So can we expect that the COVID-19 shock is even more about lower for longer? Well, there are several reasons to think so. So one reason, which is an important one, is a big increase in uncertainty due to the pandemics, which leads to more precautionary savings. And especially if we have a phenomenon called the scarring of beliefs, meaning what when people have experienced a catastrophic shock, they may be more likely to expect such a shock in the future, and this will increase their precautionary savings. So there's a lot of savings in some bank accounts and hopefully elsewhere. We have an aggregate demand decrease due to COVID-19, which is likely bigger than the supply shocks that we have been experiencing. So all these factors would put further pressure downwards on the real rate. However, we have to recognize that there are also some forces due to COVID-19 that could actually put upward pressure on the real rates. So one such possibility is some more unexpected supply shock pushing up inflation and therefore monetary policy response to this shock. We could also see, and that's a different perspective, a dive in inflation expectation, not offset by a similar decrease in nominal interest rates, possibly because monetary policy becomes less effective. Finally, we have the issue of a fiscal monetary nexus, more debt, in particular more public debt, showing up in many balance sheets now, and the corresponding effect on savings, so total savings going down because of that, and possible effect on the risk premium. All that would put upward pressure on real rates. Now, it is hard to make the balance of these factors, and data is a little bit hard to come by in order to answer the question based on past records, because fortunately, we didn't have that many pandemics. However, there has been some interesting attempts made by researchers going back to the 14th century and looking at all the pandemic episodes. And what they have found in these studies is that, yes, after pandemics, the real rates tend to go down. And it tends to go down in a very persistent way, the peak being after 20 years, in a way which is relatively heterogeneous across countries, but which is long-lasting. So it's a little bit bold to infer something from these past reports, because indeed, the structure of the economies has changed a lot over the centuries. However, this may be an indication that COVID-19 will put further pressure downwards on the real rate. Now, to conclude, I think based on this analysis of macroeconomic forces that I just put forward to you, that lower for longer is more likely than not. But it's not because of structural trends. In fact, I've put the spotlight on what I believe is more likely to be driving what we are seeing, which is the boom-bust cycle trajectory rather than structural strengths in the economy.
So, according to Professor Ray, we are facing at least 2 decades of zero to sub-zero sovereign bond yields. Not a thrilling prospect for leverage-constrained investors who typically target 5% plus cash. But debate is lively over the direction of inflation given the huge injection of capital in the markets by the central banks. Despite the historic analysis, central banks could still surprise by raising rates to head off inflation or even to stem the threat of Japan-style deflation. Truly extraordinary times ahead, which could rewire financial markets and push yield-seeking fixed income investors into much riskier categories. To what outcome? Bond markets could also get a massive shakeup from regulator efforts to prevent further moral hazard from the multi-billion dollar prime money market fund sector. These funds, financial instruments that invest in non-government, high-quality, short-term debt, cash, and cash equivalents, typically with a maturity of less than a year, are considered one of the most liquid and low-risk markets and relied upon by many businesses to cover operational expenses. But as the pandemic escalated back in March 2020, these funds experienced huge, unexpected outflows. The sector froze. The US Federal Reserve was forced to step in to backstop the market and prevent an all-out liquidity crunch. This wasn't the first time either. Just 12 years ago, the financial crisis caused a similar run on the sector when the troubles at Lehman Brothers caused panicked redemptions at one large prime money market fund that held millions of Lehman Brothers debt obligations. A few years later, regulators introduced tough new rules governing money market funds to prevent such a liquidity crisis from occurring again. Now the sector is once again under scrutiny. What does the future hold for prime funds and the businesses that rely on them to buy their paper? This was one question posed live to Anil Kashyap, Stevens Distinguished Service Professor of Economics and Finance, the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and external member of the Bank of England's Financial Policy Committee by one of the delegates at the event. And this was his answer.
I guess there's different kinds of money funds. For the aficionados that follow what the Financial Conduct Authority and the Financial Policy Committee have been talking about, we've been on this problem for over a year now, talking about some of the issues with open-end funds. I think the funds that offer promises of liquidity when the underlying assets are fundamentally illiquid are the source of these troubles. You know, straight up government money market funds are usually pretty much able to deliver on their promise. I mean, there may be a small first mover advantage, but the problem in some of these, let's say, so-called prime funds, where the underlying assets might be things like that commercial paper that rarely trades, and that if you actually had to trade, it would involve a significant price concession, are a real issue. And you'll notice that the Financial Stability Board has surfaced that in their paper that was just released. This is an area of intense interest and a subject on which the FPC is continuing to consider possible remedies. I don't know that banning them all together is necessarily the answer, but I do think allowing somebody to promise liquidity when it's not there is not a good idea. And, you know, one of the things you could do is try to have more transparency around what is actually involved when you put money into one of these accounts and whether or not you can get them. The policy recommendation from the FPC has been the principle that we care about is that the liquidity of the assets and the ability to offer claims against them should be aligned. So you shouldn't have daily redemptions on securities that can't be sold without price impact within a day.
Anil spoke about the urgent need to modernize liquidity monitoring and measurement of activities of non-bank financial institutions, which have grown in importance after the 2008 financial crisis. He was asked if the leverage of non-bank financial institutions was a concern.
The problem comes for two reasons. First of all, if markets become illiquid and anybody has to sell to raise money to replace some funding that's disappeared, then that creates a bigger need. It can be pro-cyclical because you sell, the price moves, that forces others to sell. And then the leverage amplifies all of that. So in the basis trade where you've got, you know, leverage of 25 or 40 to 1, it doesn't take a very big price dislocation to create enough losses to where you then have to exit the position and sell quite a bit, or your risk managers just push you out of it. So the leverage is definitely a consideration, but I think it can also just be market illiquidity. Either of those two things in stress will amplify the funding needs. And fundamentally, those are the same two factors that give rise to the precautionary demand for balances. Some of this is just, I think things are going to get worse tomorrow, so I better sell while I can today, or I better just not lend and hoard my resources. So these frictions do matter, and the loss absorbency of the parties that are involved matter a lot too. And our ability to measure it, as I said, is not great. You know, the line about the 21st century financial system being measured through a 20th century telescope is pretty apt. It's a real problem.
Pension funds, of course, are one of the major actors in the modern market-based financial system, accounting for trillions of dollars. These schemes make promises to ordinary savers that they will be able to retire in financial security. But most major defined benefit or semi-defined benefit funds have actually been underfunded for years, or in the case of some US funds, ever. The COVID-19 shock and a long horizon of low interest rates has compounded their troubles. The solvency of some of these schemes is now in question, with either benefits under threat or savers forced to increase their contributions as household budgets are already squeezed. Is there another way for these funds to navigate a difficult situation? And will financial regulators eventually have to step in to stabilize the system? Joshua Rao, Ormond Family Professor of Finance, Stanford Graduate School of Business, and Senior Fellow at Hoover Institution, gives his views.
It's very important to consider that a regulator could have two potential roles and could play both of them. One is in simply the measurement of the liabilities. You know, securities regulators would be interested potentially in ensuring that the liabilities are measured in a way that the purchasers of the securities of an entity that also has pension liabilities are aware of the true extent of those pension liabilities, and so therefore might want to impose a measurement regime on pension funds. There is a separate goal, which would be funding, ensuring the appropriate funding of pension obligations. And there, a regulator might be interested in appropriate funding for a variety of reasons. One of them could also be the same securities regulation reason as the disclosure requirements. Another could be in order to protect beneficiaries from pension cuts, or in order to protect, say, taxpayers or those who look at government finances from the potential for bailouts.
Well, that picture seems pretty bleak. Are there any other possible answers?
The third part of it is, of course, government support. I do see in a number of places a movement towards government support. Certainly in the U.S., a couple of pension systems in the U.S. have explicitly floated the idea of using the Federal Reserve's Municipal Liquidity Facility, which is a facility that buys municipal bonds in order to come up with the resources to fund pensions. So I see places where pension rights are weak are places where pensions will be impaired or reduced. That's kind of what we've been seeing in the Netherlands to some extent, accompanied by contribution increases. Places where pension rights are strong will rely on contribution increases to the extent that the sponsor is able to remain solvent. And there will also be, in all situations, requests for further government support of these pension promises. And that's really the wild card, I think, for pension systems in planning in the U.S. in particular, but I think in other places, is the extent to which they may be eligible to receive government support through expansions of government programs, maybe that already exist to support pension promises, but that could be expanded in the name of protecting beneficiaries of these pension funds.
It sounds like the taxpayer is in for a rough ride if Professor Rao's analysis plays out. Keith Ambachir, Director Emeritus, International Center for Pension Management at the Rotman School of Management, University of Toronto, and President of KPA Advisory Services, says a rethink of global pensions design, governance, and risk management is needed. He says urgent action must be taken to address the growing funding challenges for pension schemes to meet their promises in a low-for-long interest rate environment. At the start of his career, Ambachir read business thinker Drucker's 1976 book, The Unseen Revolution. He was inspired, and Drucker's insights helped to influence his recommendations for the portfolio and governance design of the Ontario Teachers' Pension Plan, which were adopted and eventually rolled out to other Canadian pension funds. He is keen to see US and European governments follow suit.
I think most of you are familiar with the old 60-40 rule of thumb. It's been around for decades, and it's kind of the default historically for an asset mix policy for pension funds. Historically, it's generated, give or take, 4% real. And with that kind of real return, you can generate an adequate pension at affordable contribution rates. Don't need to get into the details because that depends on you know, how long you work, when you retire. But generally speaking, you can get good pensions, depending on how you define good, somewhere between 10 and 20% of pay. And that seems like an affordable way to generate pensions in a working life of 35, 40 years. But now we have a problem, and the problem is the theme, of course, of this event. which is that old 60-40 used to work fine when you had, you know, bonds or stocks yielding or returning 4, 5, 6% real, and long-term bonds were doing nicely at a 2 or 3% real, again, depending on the time period you look at. You take 60-40 and it all works. If we now live in a world where real bond yields are negative, then 60-40 doesn't work anymore. It can't produce that 4% real that we've historically depended on to make the pension system work. And in fact, if it's not just on the negative real return, it's just not COVID related. It's been a much larger, more macro issue for almost a decade now. And again, looking forward, if you look at, you know, some of the drivers of that, slower GDP growth, aging population, savings clubs, falling capital goods pricing, falling capital good demand, all of these things are longer term phenomena. And realistically, I think we have to deal with the reality that those bond yields are going to stay very low for a very long period of time. And so this is not just a short term issue. This is a longer term challenge. What can we do about it? And now let's go to Mr. Drucker, Peter Drucker, and see where he comes into this story. And basically what he did is he took the boomers at that time were still young, but he projected a few decades further and saw, you know, a very large cohort that would eventually become retirees. And he argued that that would have a number of implications for how we needed to think about generating retirement income long term. And what he said basically was that, you know, it's not just a pension design issue, although that's important in terms of sustainability. It's also about the kind of institutions that we need to create in order to, you know, manage long-term retirement savings. So I took that up, reading that, and in terms of subsequent advisory work that I did, I had a chance to work with the Ontario Task Force in the 1980s that was tasked to look at the design and management of public sector pension organizations in Ontario, which led to a report, In Whose Interest, that came out in 1987. And part of those recommendations was the idea that we should adopt Drucker's recommendations as to what the key success drivers of pension organizations should be in terms of mission clarity, good governance, and the ability to marshal the resources necessary to be effective. And something magical happened that doesn't happen very often. These recommendations were actually taken up by the Ontario government and the Ontario Teachers Federation, led to the creation of the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan in 1990. And it radicalized the management of pension systems in the sense that it started out with a clear mission. It started out with some very strong rules about creating a strong governance function. And it started out with having no constraints as to how the mission is best accomplished. And that led over time through a lot of insourcing, scale, flexibility in pension designs. Eventually, as more and more Canadian organizations picked up this model, it became international. It was written up in The Economist about 5, 6 years ago as the Canadian pension model. And the notion is the sustainable integration of pension design, governance and investing, which over time meant strong governments, strong insourcing, and the effective conversion of retirement savings into wealth-producing capital. And by that, I mean that the notion of stocks and bonds almost disappeared, and the new focus became acquiring sustainable cash flows and nurturing those sustainable cash flows over time.
Will governments in Europe and the US turn to Drucker's ideas in a dark time for defined benefit pension schemes? The financial pressures as a result of the pandemic have exacerbated underfunding problems that have inflated over a decade of low interest rates. Without some tough decisions, major schemes could go bankrupt, leaving savers empty-handed. It's not a problem that will go away. The Insight Summit concluded with a stimulating and lively fireside chat between Mohamed El Arian, President, Queen's College, Cambridge, and London Business School's Richard Portes, professor of economics and also academic director of the AQR Asset Management Institute. El Arian was an international monetary fund economist and for 7 years was CEO and co-chief investment officer for the global investment management firm PIMCO. El Arian has been outspoken about the scarring impact of COVID-19 on the world's economy and the policy action required to reboot economic growth, which he told Richard will take much longer than expected. In a session focusing on the pandemic's impact on emerging economies, he says,
when you look at emerging markets during the last 9 months, it's been very much like Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, the best of world and the worst of world. You would have expected more accidents because of the worst of worlds. And the worst of world included lower export receipts, virtually no tourism receipts, lower remittances, lower foreign direct investment. And the typical emerging economy has at least two or three of these four sources of revenues as a really important source. So you would have expected more accidents. But really, we've gotten very, very few. And the reason for that is that it's been the best of worlds on financing. If you've had access to the capital markets, you've been able to issue a lot very cheaply. Not because you're particularly attractive. It's not an absolute attractiveness. It's a relative attractiveness. You're a lot more attractive to everything else for the reasons we've heard all this afternoon, which is these very, very low rates for long. If you don't have access to the capital markets, the IMF has responded much faster than ever before, and the international community has responded much faster than any before with debt service suspension, the DSSI initiative. So what you've lost on the real economy side, you've gained on the financial side. Now, to go back to what Ellen said, the challenge is going to be for G to be greater than R, for these countries to be able to generate the sort of economic growth needed to accommodate the much higher debt stock that they've taken on.
But R is going to be very low for a long time, no?
I worry about the G side of it, and not just for emerging economies. I worry about the G side of it for the advanced world as well. I think that the scarring involved here may mean that it's much higher to get back to proper growth than we currently think it is.
Has low for long and the search for yield been a good thing for the emerging markets?
Short term, it has been a good thing because it pushes capital to the emerging world. And it pushes capital to the emerging world because people are looking for, quote, yield pickup. But we've learned a few things. You know, we've had quite a few bouts of these things. One is that the ability of countries to absorb that capital efficiently varies a great deal, a great deal. And in some cases, it is absorbed in a very inefficient manner. So you cannot translate financial flows into increased productive capabilities. Second, the nature of the investor matters. I call this tourist dollars as opposed to resident dollars. That is very important to understand because it's an asset class that will overshoot on the way up, it will overshoot on the way down because these technicals become the price setter. And there's really good theoretical reason why that happens. It's simply not appreciated enough when people look at who is investing in emerging markets.
What does this mean for exchange rates and for the emerging markets going forward? Do we see an overall appreciation of emerging markets rates relative to, say, the dollar, a dollar longer term depreciation against those markets?
So that has been the view in markets for the last 4 to 5 years. And I have been sort of on the other side of that view. And the reality is, if you had invested on that view, you are disappointed today. In fact, this year is the first year, and the last few months is the first time we've really outperformed. But local currency emerging markets has not been a great friend for investors, even though you've had that effect. Why? Because there's so much else going on that impact the exchange rate. And understanding that and the hit you're getting on the balance of payment is something influencing exchange rate. The way countries use the exchange rate as a shock absorber also plays in. So if you are just looking at it on just that very limited view, you are capturing a very small part of the picture. I think, Richard, the most stunning thing for me is you've had massive depreciation in the exchange rate without things breaking. Turkey, Argentina. It is truly remarkable how much these currencies have moved, and we haven't had the normal breakage that you expect when these currencies do move like that, given what happened in the past.
Yes, I think that goes back to the question of why we haven't seen as much disruption in emerging markets as we might have expected to see. And there are some real puzzles out there. But let me shift gear a bit and stay with emerging markets in a way, but try to bring that in with our low for long theme, in particular, looking at demographics. One story about the downward trend in real rates since the mid-1980s is that it was due to the integration of China and other low-income countries into the world economy, this huge reserve of labor, low-cost labor, that meant a big increase in the effective labor supply to the global economy, which then lowered the relative price of labor in the aggregate and led to a fall in investment because labor was substituting for capital. Now you might think that partly because of aging in China, partly because a lot of that labor surplus has been absorbed by growth in these economies, not just China, but other low-income countries, that reserve army of labor, if you like, has been exhausted, and that it's going to turn around, and that investment will have to go up to make up for a labor shortage overall in the global economy, and hence interest rates will go up. What do you think about that picture?
So I could certainly tell that story. It is consistent with Ellen Ray. I loved her presentation, by the way, about the notion of the intersection between structural trends and the boom-bust cycle. And I think that the one thing that's underappreciated in this whole story so far today is that central banks took on many responsibilities, not by choice, by necessity, using imperfect tools. And that has resulted in quite a distortion of interest rates in addition to everything else we see. And I say that because that's not going to go away. For me, the central bank has become an insurance company. It insures us, and us has to go through the marketplace because the asset channel is the only way that can operate on this. It insures us against all sorts of risks. And they've been increasingly insuring us. And not only are they finding out that when you do that, there's both moral hazard, adverse selection, all the classic issues we know about insurance, but in addition, they're insuring a risk that's very hard to price and that's almost impossible to underwrite sustainably. They need a handoff. They need a handoff to other policymakers who can produce genuine growth. Without genuine growth, this whole insurance model becomes really problematic in a few years' time.
What a wonderful way to finish off an excellent event of thought-provoking insights and different perspectives on the seismic challenges facing investors, pension funds, households, and policymakers as we head into the uncharted macroeconomic and monetary policy territory. The next few years will certainly be extraordinary. New markers will be laid down for future market conduct as regulators attempt to create a monitoring system fit for the 21st century. But will they be behind the curve again? Governments, particularly in developed markets, have serious decisions to make on tax and spend policies to pay off mountains of debt and spark the embers of economic growth. We are in for a fascinating ride. Thank you for listening. To discover more insights from our distinguished speakers, videos of our presentations are available on the AQR Asset Management Institute's website. Go to london.edu/AQR Institute. You can also find the full conversation between Mohammed and Richard available there. For more on the topics explored in this podcast, please go to london.edu/think.